Let's turn tonight to the book of Esther.
The book of Esther.
This is the second study in this particular book. We've emphasized that like no other book of the Old Testament, the book of Esther is a crisis book. And that simply means there is one single critical crisis moment or crisis event that occurs in the book. And we can take the entire book of Esther, and it forms itself perfectly naturally around two parts of the crisis. One, anticipation of, and that is chapters 1 through 5. Everything in those chapters is a part, is a segment that leads up to the crisis. In chapter 6, on through the end of the book, chapter 10, you have the overruling of the crisis by the sovereignty of God. And therefore, out of this develops the theme. And the theme is the providence of God in caring for His people. Providence of God in caring for His own. And we will find out that in this context, and we tend to think this way, that God cares for you if you take care of yourself. And that God cares for you if you obey Him. And that God cares for you if you live the right kind of life. Or to use preaching vernacular, God only uses a clean vessel. That is not true. We will find in the book of Esther, and we'll see more of it tonight, everything that Esther and Mordecai did, especially Esther, and especially in chapter 2, everything they did was wrong. Every move they made was almost a blatant offense against the will of God. And yet, God will take all of those events and it will be woven together for something that will bring honor to Him. Now, that does not mean that we therefore have license to do as we please. Should Esther have gone into the king's harem? Should Esther have married the king? Absolutely not. The whole thrust of the Old Testament, as a matter of fact, we'll see in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, there was a great demand on the part of the prophets of God, divorce your wives if they're Gentiles. And we have much of that in Ezra and Nehemiah, and that was the cry, and that was the sin of the times, a very major sin of the times, was the intermarriage with the Gentiles. And therefore, Esther is doing exactly what God said do not do. Mordecai is encouraging her to do, teaching her to do what is contrary to the will of God. And it's wrong in every sense of the word. However, the providence of God is going to be there in a very, very clear and a very obvious manner in the approach to the book. The first event we had in anticipation of the crisis was the banquet. We said chapter 1 of Esther is labeled secular, secular, secular. And all we have to do to remind ourselves of that is the king's banquet of Xerxes is called. Notice down in 6 and 7, it's all secular. God is not in it. Verse 6, there were hangings of fine white, violet linen, held by cords of fine purple linen on silver rings and marble columns, couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, precious. That's the king's palace. As a secular, godless, and heathen, and pagan as it can be. But it is nonetheless the focal point. Verse 7, drinks were served in golden vessels of all kinds, and the royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. And therefore, in the early verses, you have the king's banquet, you have the parallel banquet in verse 9, held by Vashti. There was nothing by law that said she had to do that. They simply had a women's banquet separate for some reason, whatever it might be. Then you come down to verse 10, where the king becomes intoxicated and says, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine. That means he had drunk enough that his judgment was impaired. And with that impaired judgment, he issues a command. And keep asking yourself, I hope you will, where is God in all of this? And you look at the scene in front of us, and God is not there, but God is there. And the lesson will be God cannot be written out of anything. He is there even if we try to write Him out. So, under the influence of wine, he orders to bring, verse 11, Queen Vashti before the king with a royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. And we said on this, and I think it was our closing word in our last study, that the two means of interpretation of verse 12, one is a typical Jewish interpretation that says she was to appear nude. And therefore, the only thing she was to wear was to be in verse 11, to be her crown, and displaying of her beauty was the beauty of her body. The argument in favor of that is fairly strong. In the first place, she said no. It was not normal for the queen to say no when the king wished an audience. Under ordinary circumstances, and I would venture to say that every other time the king had called in Vashti, she came without question. This time she does not. Why? There must be something unusual about the request, and that perhaps is exactly what it is. Others take it to mean that her beauty is not her physical body as much as it is her jewels, her robes, all of the things that would be befitting to the queen. The question would be, what woman would ever say no to displaying her best dresses and her best jewelry? That would seem appealing, that the king appreciates this dress, the way I look, and most likely she would have agreed to appear. So there has to be something highly unusual and irregular about the command, and perhaps the Jewish interpretation best explains what that appearance was meant to be. Well, with that, then, the king loses all of his cool. We'll say some things about him, three things that we know about Xerxes in verse 12. Last sentence, when she said no, then the king became very angry, and his wrath burned within him. Then the king calls in those who understand the times. Astrologers is our word for it. He called in the astrologers, for it was the custom of the king to speak before all who knew law and justice and were close to him. And he names those seven princes of Persian Media that had immediate access to the king. And he wishes to know, verse 15, what is my legal recourse? What can I do with the queen who has said no? And so the deliberations begin. Secular sources tell us a few things that are interesting about Xerxes. Remember, Ahasuerus is not a name. It's an office. The man's name was Xerxes. And from secular sources, we have several things that confirm the man loses his temper. He is so angry, he dethrones the queen, and he divorces her. And let me give you a couple of things that pertain to Xerxes that fit within the book of Esther that are also borne out by secular history. Number one, Xerxes was very impulsive and unreasonable. He was very impulsive and unreasonable when he did not get what he wanted. For example, secular history records that he went to battle just about 2 years from this event in chapter 1, goes to battle with the Greeks, went to battle with them in 480, got absolutely clobbered by the naval forces of Greece, went again into battle, and by the ground forces is totally annihilated in 479. And one of the notes made by secular history, and it fits this guy right here, can you imagine a man whose wife would say no, and he dethroned her, put her under the law of Medes and Persians, which said you can never, ever come back to the place you have now, ever. And he knew that. And he inquired, how can I come down that hard? Impulsive and unreasonable. And the secular history then fits very much in with the actions that we have in chapter 1. A bridge was built by his engineers for military reasons. A storm came up. The storm washed out the bridge. He had the engineers executed, and he took off his belt and beat the water. And you can picture a man in control of everything down there strapping the water. Very impulsive. And though that's somewhat understandable, there are some people, when something doesn't work, what's your first thought? Some men think, fix it. I always think, destroy it. I mean, annihilate it. Make it really a job to fix. But at any rate, this was part of Xerxes. Later on, for example, he is going to propose, because of the bad disposition of one of these cabinet members in the book of Esther, he is going to propose the extinction of all Jews on one day. And that's a little bit impulsive. Two, we know he was very powerful. He had the largest kingdom, the largest empire to appear in the East. All the ones that went before were nothing comparing to the empire of Xerxes. Third, and maybe this is a little interpretive, but I think you'll see if my illustrations support it, he was very insecure. And with that insecurity, a manifestation of it was the fact that his losses were compensated for by pleasure. If he would lose something or fail to get something, then his answer was, let's party till the feeling is gone. Herodotus says that in the seventh year of his reign, when he was defeated by the Greeks, his immediate response was to hurry back to his harem. And there he attempted to satisfy himself in that way. The Esther 2 basically is going to be a description of a harem. And you say, where in the world is God in the description of a Persian harem? And you would say, God is out of the picture. He's written out. He's disregarded. He's ignored. But Esther is going to teach he was very, very much there because he cannot be ruled out of existence. So we have then a few things then about this man coming down to verse 12. The king became very angry. His wrath burned within him. Then he said, verse 13, to the wise men who understood the times, he brings them in, their names are given. Verse 15, he says, according to the law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti? Because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, delivered by the eunuchs. And in the presence of the king and the princess, Memucan said, and notice the people that surround him, are just about as irrational as he is, and just about as impulsive as he is. And that probably indicates that Xerxes surrounded himself with men of like character. I mean, he went nuts over something, and so what did he surround himself with? A lot of other people who go nuts with you. He was impulsive himself, so he surrounded himself with impulsive people. And notice the whole thrust of what happens is this. First of all, you've got their rationale. And the rationale is explained in verse 17. The queen's conduct, she said no once, will become known to all the women, that's in the empire, causing to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought into his presence, but she did not come. And then notice in the following verse, they simply do this. They create a simple matter and turn it into a national crisis. So let's simply put down what they do. A simple matter is treated as a national crisis. And the national crisis is going to be male superiority is threatened. We've got to do something or the women are going to take over. That does not speak for a very secure cabinet of Xerxes, but that's exactly what they see. And notice that's stated in verse 17. The queen's conduct will become known to all the women. Simple incident, national crisis, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, King Xerxes commanded the Queen Vashti to be brought into his presence. She did not come. And this day, the ladies of Persia and Media will have heard of the queen's conduct and will speak in the same way to all the king's princes, and there will be plenty of contempt and anger. So the rationale is very much there. Two aspects of it. Simple matter balloons into a national crisis. And the national crisis is male superiority is now threatened. So out of that comes their policy. These men in 14, and Scripture does not call it that, but looking at them, I think a good caption would be the jerks of Xerxes. At any rate, notice the recommendation comes, and those first five words are so typical of everybody that talks to Xerxes. Everybody that talks to him speaks deferentially. You can trace this phrase through Esther and over and over and over again. Nobody ever says, here's what we ought to do. Nobody ever sees and says the issue. They always say, now, if it please the king, may I please say this? And that is just almost universal throughout the entire book. You'll see it over and over again. If it pleases the king, deferential speech, verse 19, let a royal edict be issued by him and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti should come no more into the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. So, the law of the Medes and the Persians, and we ought to say something about that, the law of the Medes and the Persians was unique in all law. And the thing that made it unique was once a thing, and everything was not put in the law of the Medes and Persians. But if it was, it had one characteristic, irrevocable. It could never be changed. The king could change his mind. Everybody in the kingdom could change their mind. But you could not repeal. You could not amend. You could not alter. You could not change the law of the Medes and Persians in any way. For a clear statement of that, go to Daniel 6, keeping Esther open, but Daniel 6. And since she was divorced under the law and dethroned under the law of the Medes and the Persians, there's no way back ever for her. Daniel chapter 6, verse 14. Then, as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed. And what the statement was is not a big deal, but it had to do with the prayers of the faithful Israelites. Then, as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, recognize, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or statute which the king established or establishes may be changed. We even have in English occasionally an expression that when something is irrevocable, you say, is this the law of the Medes and the Persians? And the meaning of that, is there any way this can be amended? Is there any way it can be changed? And the answer was no. So going back to Esther, you see the seriousness of what is happening. Verse 19, if it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued by him, let him be written in the laws of the Persia and Media, so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti should come no more into the presence of King Xerxes, and let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. And when the king's edict, which he shall make, is heard throughout all the kingdom, great as it is, then all the women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. And you wonder about even their wisdom on a practical level with women. How many people respond to an edict? Not very well. An edict is usually a challenge to do it. And so even psychologically it seems weak, and at any rate, this word pleased, verse 21, the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. Of course, how could anyone ever listen to somebody named Memucan anyway? But nonetheless, he makes a proposal, And then finally, in the last verse, he makes a bulk mailing. And his bulk mailing, his point is this. I want to be sure. He's convinced that her offense is going to be publicized. How are you going to stop that? Everybody's going to know she said no. Well, doesn't it make sense then? We better publicize the punishment as widely as the act of the queen is publicized. So, for that purpose, verse 22, and according to history, Persia had a superb postal system. And thus, verse 22, he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, to every people according to their language, that every man should be master in his own house, and the one who speaks in the language of his own people. So he's to control the language or the dialect spoken in the house, and he's to control his own house. And thus, we end chapter 2. And I ask once again, where's God? His name's not there. There's no pronoun that can be referenced to him. It's a palace. It's a pagan. It's an irrational king. It's words that he will later regret and wish he could recall. It's a pagan system. Where is God? So let's make and conclude chapter 1 with a set of observations. Now, in doing this, let me say I'm going to teach Esther a little bit differently than we do often. Sometimes throughout the chapter, we will make observations. In the book of Esther, I think we need to see the narrative, and therefore, when we get into chapter 2, we're just going to look at what's there. Then we'll back off and make observations. So, seeing the content of chapter 1, what can we learn from the chapter? Number 1, this chapter teaches the weakness of human rule. It teaches the weakness of human rule. Now, how does it do that? It does that by noting this. Everybody in the empire said yes, except one. And she said no. And it's almost humorous, isn't it, that Xerxes can command armies, he can command rulers, he can command princes, he can say jump, and everybody will say how high, and everybody will obey him, and his wife, he says jump. And there she stands. What a powerful man. Controls the world, but not his home. And we might put with that a principle, by the way. The greatest ruler, or greatest rulers, the greatest rulers who have ever lived eventually meet something or someone that they cannot rule. The greatest rulers eventually meet someone they cannot rule. And typically, when they do, they go bananas. And that's the typical character trait, and we can learn that off of chapter 1 of the book of Esther. Second, chapter 1 teaches the falseness of human praise. Chapter 2 teaches the falseness of human praise. And that comes particularly off of Vashti. The banquet is going on, and the king says, I want to bring in front of my party my prized possession, the greatest woman that ever lived. Here's Vashti. And within the next day, he says, divorce her. Falseness of human praise, what was so great one day, suddenly is set aside. 3. Esther chapter 1 teaches the hiddenness of God. Teaches the hiddenness of God. Chapter 1 is secular, as we said, from beginning to end. You have a pagan king, a Persian palace, occult advisors, astrologers, a lavish banquet, a stag party with plenty to drink, and where is God? Well, we'll find out, and this will be throughout not only chapter 1, but throughout the entire book. God is at work. He's hidden. He is not obvious. And what we mean by the hiddenness of God is simply this. He is working. He is strictly from the shadows. It is not front center stage. It is from the shadows. Four. Chapter 1 teaches the results of an uncontrolled temper. And the results with Xerxes will be, first, regret, followed by no recourse. Nothing can be healed. It's all over. It's done. And so we have the edict in chapter 1, and you come now to chapter 2. After these things, when the anger of King Xerxes has subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed against her. He could do nothing about any of it. He could regret it, which he did. He could wish to change it, but it's the law of the Medes and the Persians, and he cannot. All because his temper could not be controlled. Fifth and finally, Esther 1 teaches, as will the rest of the book, how dispensable man is in God's program. How dispensable man is. For that, go to chapter 4, verse 14, and I give this ahead because we are coming up to it, but I'd like for you to see it beforehand. Before we look at 4:14, if you take Shakespeare's play Romeo and Juliet, and you take Romeo and Juliet out of the scene, what of Shakespeare's play is left? Nothing. Pull Esther out of the book of Esther, and what is left? God. Chapter 4, verse 14, that point is made. Well, let's go back to verse 13. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you and the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, the whole program is blown." Not at all. If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have attained royalty for such a time as this. And he's simply saying, God's program for protecting his people is in operation, and he's going to do it. Are you going to be part of it? That's fine. Are you not part of it? The program is unaltered. Pull out Esther from the book of Esther, and you still have the book of Esther. Pull out Romeo and Juliet from the play, and the play is over with. And that is, again, emphasizing what? There is no hidden God in Romeo and Juliet. There is a human, hidden God behind the book of Esther, and it's all very, very important. All right, we've got time enough then to get started with chapter 2. Okay, this was all assumed, pulled together, outline. Crisis anticipated, chapter 1 through chapter 5. Chapter 1, dethronement of Vashti, and that was a big A under the crisis anticipated, the first part of it, the first block leading up to this crisis. Dethronement of Vashti, and now B, the rise of Esther. And we start out the chapter with Xerxes' problem. 2:1. Xerxes' problem. 2:1. And notice verse 1 describes the problem this man is wrestling with from two angles. It says, after these things, and we'll want to take some time to describe what after these things means and how much time is involved there, but after these things, at least something happens. And after these things happened, When the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti. And so notice the first part of his problem is described in terms of subdued anger. He's through being mad. His temper has calmed. In that verse that says the anger subsided, that's an interesting verb, subsided, because you can really get a mental image with it. The verb translated subsided is also subsided, is also found in Genesis 8, verse 1. And don't turn to it, let me simply read it to you, and you should be able to get a mental image of this overwhelming anger is now beginning to bubble down. And that same verb that is used for the subsiding of his temper is also used in Genesis 8. Listen to it. We're in the flood. God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark. And God caused a wind to pass over the earth, and the water, the floods, this verb, subsided. So if you can picture a whole earth, water enshrouded, God says the word, and over a period of days, it goes down and down and down and down and down. Didn't disappear all at once, but day by day by day by day. Off of that usage then, in chapter 2, King Ahasuerus had been undergoing a period of time in his life where week by week by week by week, that burning anger that dethroned and divorced Vashti in chapter 1 is now subsiding. It's now becoming not a flood anymore, but it's coming under the idea of control. So anger had flooded his heart, and it's now recovering. It's also described, his problem is described in terms of subdued anger. It's also in terms of very bitter regret. And you can read that so well in verse 1. He remembers Vashti, what she had done, what he had decreed against her. And of course he regrets it, but nothing can be done about it at all. The Jewish interpretations are usually a little bit strange. The Jewish interpreters ask at this point, why didn't he simply recall Vashti to the throne? Your answer, and mine would be the same thing, and I think it's the best answer, is what? Daniel 6, 14, 15, as well as in the book of Esther. The law of the Medes and Persians cannot be changed. The Jewish explanation is he couldn't recall Vashti because she'd been executed. And of course, if she was executed, that's probably true. Probably cannot affect the resurrection. So that was true. But I think that the Daniel 6, 14 is a better explanation. Now, what about the time? What about the time between chapter 1 and 2? Have any idea of how long this period of time was? And we can fix that. In the first place, we know, looking at Esther 1:3, where we are in his reign. Because it was in the third year of his reign that he calls the banquet. And at that banquet, she is divorced. In chapter 2, he's going to find a new queen, which will be Esther. And that follows these things. And if you go down to chapter 2 and look at verse 16, you have another time fix. So Esther was taken to King Xerxes to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And therefore, we are able to put between Esther 1 and Esther 2 an answer to the question, how long? 4 years. Now, we can put some history into that also, because we've now got a time frame, and we know that if he gave the party in 482, third year of his reign, the party or the banquet, putting it on the scale, was in 482. And we can be sure of these dates. They're not maybes. Okay, if that was in 482, the year he dethroned Vashti, then you go down to 478 for the for the coronation and the taking of Esther as queen, and all you need to do is say what happened between 482 and 478 with the king. And that can easily be filled in. Number one was his naval defeat at Salamis, 480. Then in 479, he had a total rout by the Greeks at Plataea, P-L-A-T-E-A. No, A-E it is. A-E-A. Plataea. P-L-A-T-A-E-A. Total humiliation was involved. So he comes back depressed after being beaten on land and sea. He comes back in chapter 2 and he's depressed. And he begins to think, I'm not as mad at Vashti as I used to be. Remember what she did? I remember what I did. Boy, I'd like to have her back. But he can't have that. And therefore, one of his brilliant advisors in human relations says, Xerxes, I understand your soul. I understand your problem. I've got a cure for you. And the cure is about as deep as and shallow as anything could be. The solution is given by his cabinet, and we would move then to his advisor's answer. His cabinet's answer. And that's in verses 2 through 4. 2 through 4. And it's so simple. All you need is a new, young, virgin queen. And that causes me to make a note at this point. Xerxes' advisors from beginning to end have no divine viewpoint in their mentality, and therefore they always give bad to disastrous advice. There is no divine viewpoint. None. Among them. Therefore, their advice is, on a scale, bad to disastrous. Okay, the king regrets what he's done in a fit of temper. He comes back after being defeated. The answer is purely on the flesh of the material level. All you need is a new, young, virgin queen. Put God in that. And God isn't in that, but God is in that because God can't be squeezed out, and it's part of his hiddenness. So then, in essence, the advice is that your soulless will be a new virgin queen. Now, here's where we need a little fill-in, because what do we understand about a harem? You see a guy with three girls on his arm, and he's got a harem. It has nothing to do with a harem. And we need to understand a little bit about the fact that in every, and we'll just insert this here, something about the harem, doctrine of harem, okay, to recognize that the harem, or the Greeks gave it a different name, G-Y-N, gynaecium, A-E, C-E-U-M. And of course you can take gynaecium from the Greek word gune, as in gynecology, that means women. And it meant a collection of women. In most palaces there were two harems, managed by separate people, as was true in this chapter. Haggai and Shashbaz were the managers of the harem. The harem was in two parts. There was a harem that contained nothing but virgins, and then the other part of the harem in this case, headed by Shashgaz, was all of the girls that had spent one night with the king. And they were in that harem. They were called concubines. Concubines were simply girls that spent their virgin night with the king. And when that was over, they were put away. They were never heard from again unless he called them by name. And this, where's God in all that? God is absent in the words and the actions of Esther. But God cannot be written off, and that is a major, major doctrinal lesson to be lived, to learn from this particular place. So, then we know this. This was a normal part of the king's repertoire. I shouldn't have said that. Now I've got to spell repertoire. R-E-P-E-R-T-O-I-R-E. Okay, good. Normal part of the king's repertoire. Just to get an idea, the historical records of most of your Persian kings had this. He had anywhere from 300 to 400 virgins. Then he had the rest, I don't know what to call them, used virgins. Not a used, a pre-owned. Pre-owned virgins. Okay. The used virgins were called concubines. Concubines, simply one who had spent the night with the queen, a virgin night with the king. Okay. You got that wrong. Okay. I knew this was going to happen. So, basically then, what the harem represented, we'll put a second point here, that basically the harem, from a moral standpoint, was this. The harem of the ancient kings and the kings of the Orient shows the low life of high places. The low life of high places. Or to put it in different terms, the harem demonstrate the moral perversion of the socially prominent. That does not occur anymore. There is no low life in high places, and there's no moral corruption among the socially prominent. But there was then, and that is basically what the harem represents in those times. Notice, by the way, in introduction into the harem here, the only consideration was physical. So notice beginning at verse 2. I've never understood how people can fantasize Esther into a heroine of some kind. And I think as we read the book, you'll see that. So here are these king's attendants, verse 2, who served him and said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to Susa the capital, to the harem, into the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given to them. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti." And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. You think how? Notice how deeply he thinks, how attuned he is to the realities of life. The answer will be a young virgin girl, and I can go through all of them as long as I want to every night. That's his thinking. Do you remember, let's see if I jotted that. Do you remember reading the a parallel to this? I almost said beautiful parallel, an interesting parallel to this. Have you ever read The Arabian Nights? Have you heard of The Arabian Nights? It's very interesting, and I had to go back and review it. King Shahriar had a new bride, virgin bride, each evening, and had her executed the next day, until he found a girl named Scheherazade, who won his heart and she became queen. And if you read Arabian Nights, you've got just exactly what you've got in Esther chapter 2. Esther chapter 2 can meet the Arabian Nights literature on every step because it's just as secular, just as much the king's harem as anything else could possibly be. So notice up through 2 through 4, what is the consideration for the new queen? Physical, 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 physical. 12 months they're given with oils. special diet, 12 months of discipline, to meet the king for one night. And that's as low as you can get, that is fleshly as you can possibly get, and that is what is going to happen and what is described up through verse 4. Important note that when verse 4, let the young lady, whoever she may be, comes in and pleases the queen, will be take Vashti's place. And notice in verses 5 and following, Esther is no exception. She is as much willing to be part of the flesh parade as anybody else is. Can you see, by the way, we're coming up to a crisis. And when we come to the crisis, the Jews' proposal will be to extinguish the Jews, and God will look around and say, I've got to find a clean vessel. And he finds a clean vessel and delivers the Jew, and everybody goes off happy thereafter, riding into the sunset. It's not the reality of the book of Esther. The book of Esther is God's providential care. He's in control, and he can take this jerk and this jerk. The providential care of God is how he makes jerks in concert glorify him. And that's basically what you have under the concept of the providence of God, and we'll see it here borne out in this particular book. Well, now, verse 5 in the story, we got to get Mordecai worked in. So let's just put 5 through 7. Enter Mordecai. Mordecai is a major character in the book of Esther. And we can say several things about this man. In the first place, here in chapter 2, verse 5 is the first mention. We've not seen him before. And I said he becomes a major character. We will see him mentioned 58 times hereafter. So don't tell him goodbye. He's going to be around for a long time. First mention, he enters the picture in verse 5, and he will be around and be mentioned 58 times in the book of Esther. Nowhere else. There is a Mordecai mention in Ezra chapter 2 and verse 2, and there's one in Nehemiah 7-something. But probably not the same character of all. The interesting thing about Mordecai is not how noble he was, but do you know what Mordecai is the Hebrew form of? Mordecai is the Hebrew form of Marduk. Who was Marduk? The chief god of Babylon. Chief god among the polytheists of the time. So notice how fervently Mordecai is held onto his testimony. He adopts a Jewish Hebrew designation that comes from the Babylonian god Marduk. Remember when the Jews were scattered with the captivities, the name we give to them is the diaspora. And one of the things that the diaspora started and was characteristic of them is they all adopted pagan names. Wherever they were scattered, they adopted pagan names. And that was part of the practice that was involved in there. Notice he is called in verse 5 a Jew. Jew is simply short for Judah. It's short for Judah. And the nickname started during the exile. The nickname Jew for Judah started during the period of the exile. Prior to this, they were not called Jews. So nickname, Jew for Judah during the exile, and then the practice during the exile of the adopting of pagan names, such as Mordecai, Hebrew form of the god Marduk. So let's bring him into the picture here. Now there was a Jew in Susa. Did he have to be in Susa? Should he have been in Susa? Remember what Cyrus had done? Cyrus the Persian at Ezra 1:1-3 had given an edict, all you that are faithful Jews that want to go back to Jerusalem, go on back, you're free. Mordecai didn't go. And I'm not saying that the edict was a command, but it does say this. He wasn't very sensitive to Jerusalem. He wasn't very attuned to it. because he was in Susa, and we should remember he is in Susa by choice. And as we said, the thrust of the book of Ezra is going to say, how did God take care of the Jews that didn't listen to the decree and refused to go back and stay there? So he was in Susa, the capital, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jer, Shammai, son of Kish, Benjamite, just taking him back from his father to his grandfather to his great-grandfather, who, verse 6, had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled, with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled, and he was bringing up Esther. Now, that doesn't mean bringing her up to the harem. It means educating her. He had adopted her. Her parents somewhere along the line had been killed, apparently, and he was bringing her up. Part of that bringing up, and I want you to see how God can only use vessels that are obedient to him. He had brought her up in the finest of Jewish traditions. He had brought her up to testify to her Jewish identity. No. Go down to verse 10. Esther, here's what he had taught her. Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her, probably from the time she was a little girl, that she should not make them known. And thus, this is part of the bringing up from him. And with verse 8, you then have enter Esther. We meet Mordecai now, be important. Now enter Esther, verse 8. So it came about when the command and decree of the king were heard, and many young ladies were gathered to Susa, the capital, to the custody of Haggai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace and to the custody of Haggai, who was in charge of the women. So she finds special favor, as we'll find in verse 9. The young lady pleased him. That's the manager of the virgins, found favor with him. So he quickly provided her with cosmetics, food, gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace. He provided her with cosmetics and food. Is your mind going anywhere else? Somebody else got taken into a palace and said, by the Jewish dietary law, I cannot eat the food. Remember Daniel? And notice Esther is equally as noble. No, she isn't. How can God use an Esther? Studying the providence of God is going to be found here in this particular context. Now, one question, it's the last one, we'll stop at this point with verse 11. Why do you think Mordecai taught her to deny her Jewishness, her Jewish identity? And that's really an enigma. I don't know that we know the answer to it. Let me make a couple of suggestions. Number one, just on a practical level, does it make sense that if a new queen weren't a Persian girl, she probably wouldn't stand too much of a chance? Maybe that's the reason. Mordecai knew that. If you identify yourself as an Israelite, not as a Persian girl, you're not going to stand a very good chance of making it. Maybe that was the case. We do not know. Can you think of another reason? Just get real human. Why might Mordecai, poor Jew, like for Esther to become the queen? Wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be good for the old fruit stand? Wouldn't it be good for the bagel business? If I could say my cousin is queen? Maybe. I don't know. You could argue, well, if she identified herself as a Jew, she'd be persecuted. No evidence that there was any anti-Jewish feeling at all. At least this particular, Haman will show it later, but at this particular time, there's no the Jew got along pretty good in Persia. There was no official policy, no feeling that was particularly anti-Semitic, and so that could hardly stand as a reason. There's another possibility. Notice, by the way, the will of God concerning marriage to a pagan. Does Mordecai consider that? Doesn't even cross his mind. Doesn't even cross. Esther is secular, 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 and it's a book where you see God, God, God in the hidden shadows doing his work. Now, there's one other possibility here. There was a Persian doctrine called Kitman or Takiya. And that particular doctrine of the Persians simply said this. You can legitimately deny your faith and claim to be part of another religion if you're in personal danger. And that was just part of their legal system, part of their thinking. Nothing dishonorable, nothing wrong of saying, I'm not a Jew, I'm something else, if you're in personal danger. That may be what happens if you look over at chapter 8. It's very possible that because of the good treatment the Jews received, that the remaining Persians practiced Kitmon. And in every province, and in each and every city, this is 817, wherever the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, and a feast and a holiday. Many of the people of the land became, quote, Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. So it could be an example of that particular thing in operation. Whatever it was, we will have that, and we'll pick up next time with a firsthand account of how a Persian harem worked. If you just let your eyes go down to verse 12, notice it's all just narrating. Let me tell you, let me open the door to a Persian harem and tell you what goes on. He says, verse 12, now when the turn of each young lady came to go into the king, verse 13, the young lady would go in. He's narrating what happened in the harem. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning would return to the second harem. She's now a used virgin. She's in the concubine now, to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, and so forth. Just narrates what happens in this particular context. And notice Esther fits in beautifully. When the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, came, she went into the king. Nothing noble. She is simply following the customs, the thought, the viewpoint of the time. But God, in the midst of all of this, is going to be working us up to a crisis of human making, and then we will see the overruling hand of God coming in next. So our next point, then, will be coming to chapter 2, the Persian tradition of the king's harem, 2:12-15. We'll pick it up 10 o'clock Sunday. Father, we're thankful tonight for your word, for the fact that though in the midst of the affairs of men you seem to be so hidden, but we're thankful in the shadows of human sin, God is still there. You're not written off. You are real. For which we give you thanks in Christ's name.